This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Signing by Ms. Gottlieb Walker. That's Wednesday, November 10th at Mega Evers College's S Building, 1637 Bedford Avenue in Brooklyn. For more information, call 718-270-4935. That's 718-270-4935. On Wednesday, November 10th, Mega Evers College invites you to a one-day photo exhibition and book signing. Bob Marley and the Golden Age of Reggae. Through portraits, performance, and personal shots, photographer Kim Gottlieb Walker chronicles the rise of reggae with a collection of powerful pictures, including many previously unpublished, featuring Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, Money Wailer, Lee Scratch Perry, The Heptones, Inner Circle, Jacob Miller, Jimmy Cliff, Junior Mervin, Toots and the Maytals, George Harrison, Burning Spear, Third World, and more. The exhibition takes place from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the S Building Atrium, located at 1637 Bedford Avenue in Brooklyn. At 1:30 p.m., there'll be a reception, followed by a presentation and book signing by Ms. Gottlieb Walker. That's Wednesday, November 10th at Mega Evers College's S Building, 1637 Bedford Avenue in Brooklyn. For more information, call 718-270-4935. That's 718-270-4935.
Hi everyone, I'm Gary Knoll. For 27 years, WBAI was home. Well, on November 15th, I'll be home again. What will I be doing? Well, I'll be bringing cutting-edge new information, positive affirmations, the most interesting guests. So won't you join me once again for a whole new celebration of life? Gary Knoll coming back Monday to Friday, noon to 1. Join me November 15th.
The hosts of Law and Disorder, Michael Ratner, Heidi Boghossian, and me, Michael Smith, invite you to a book launch of the magnificent civil rights labor law attorney, Ernie Goodman. It's November 1st, 6 o'clock, at the Tamament Library. That's the south side of Washington Square Park, 70 Washington Square South on the 10th floor.
We're celebrating the publication of The Color of Law, Ernie Goodman, Detroit, and the Struggle for Labor and Civil Rights.
Ernie was involved in some of the most important legal struggles of the century, from the sit-down strikes in Detroit to the civil rights movement in the South to the Attica prison rebellion in the North. Come hear this important talk.
That's at the Tamament Library, NYU, 70 Washington Square South, 10th floor, at 6 p.m. on Monday, November 1st.
When you think of the golden age of radio, you're bound to remember the performer whose hold on the heartstrings of America spanned almost three generations.
Well, thank you, Jack. Yes, it's Max Schmid, and I'm your host for the golden age of radio. Sunday nights at 7 p.m. here on WBAI, presenting the finest in radio's history, comedy, drama, mysteries, science fiction. Won't you join me Sunday nights at 7 for the golden age of radio? Only here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
I hope you feel that way too.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the web at WBAI.org. The time now is 12:03, and it is already time for Night Shift.
Don't make me destroy you.
That, sir, is illogical.
Not long.
really hang up on Chris.
Twice. My microphone's on.
Is it not?
Yes, it is.
No, I can't. I don't know. I don't hear myself.
It only happens here.
With authority and audacity.
Mondays.
Midnight.
Till 2 a.m. It only happens.
Night shift.
Joe Masseri.
Mike Sargent, how are you?
How are you?
Okay.
So I do want to say that it's been a while since it's just been us.
Uh-huh.
And we have a cavalcade now of guests.
We do.
And features and surprises. It's
all kinds of stuff. Jam-packed. It's a festival.
It's a festival. It's like the Night Shift Festival. All right. Speaking of which, you know, there's a festival coming up next week and we're going to get to talk about it?
Yes. We're going to talk about the New York City Horror Film Festival. Which kicks off with their opening night gala party on the 10th of November at Soiree at 199 Barrow.
This is Soiree. Like, do listeners get to go to the Soiree?
The listeners, it's a fundraiser for the festival. For a meager donation, less than the price of a movie ticket.
I understand.
They can attend and hobnob with filmmakers.
And you said, will you be there? Like,
I will be there.
Cape and everything?
No, there's never
been. You don't have a cape? There's a cape.
I used to have a velvet jacket, a black velvet jacket, but no cape.
It's okay, all right. Leather pants. Had a high collar.
What? The leather jacket?
The leather jacket.
No, it was more like a smoking jacket.
I understand. Well, now, so tell me what's going to happen at the Horror Film Festival. What's the concept behind it?
Mike Hine, who is somewhere out there in the streets of New York,
yes,
in one form or another, is the program director. He began the festival in 2001.
Wow. Okay.
So this is our ninth year.
Yeah. How many? Okay, go ahead.
It's our ninth year. Next year will be the big gala 10th anniversary.
Wow.
And it's programming is very simple. There's a program. We start with the gala on Wednesday.
Right.
First screening is on Thursday night.
How many films in the whole fest?
Oh, there's 10 programs. There's more than that, but there's 10 features in the festival.
10 feature films.
Yes, and every program includes a feature and a bevy of short films.
And you can only see these films here.
Correct.
Right. And so, now, what else? You have films, you have awards, you have events.
We have
awards.
We have this year. There's a couple of different things going on. The folks over at Showbiz Software here in the city, the store, are actually doing and it's open to the general public. The details are on the festival website, which is www.nychorrorfest.com. The folks who created the Red Camera.
Yes.
Are doing a demonstration and a seminar.
Really? So is it for film?
For filmmaking.
For filmmaking.
Right.
Really, that's very cool.
And it's open to the general public.
So part of the component of this film festival is not just about showing the films, but it's about getting them made. And
exactly.
And, all right.
The independent thing. And then one of our keystone features and that I enjoy, and before I got involved fully with the festival that I had been asked to be a participant in, is on Sunday at 1 o'clock. There's a filmmaker panel and brunch, and basically all the filmmakers come in and get to talk about filmmaking and independent filmmaking. And I know because you have the computer in front of you, if we have a list of the filmmakers that are in attendance. I don't remember all of them off the top of my head, but I know Bill Lustig will be there. Robert Englund will be there. Added but not on the page is Tony Todd is coming in. He'll be on the panel. Mike Gingold from Starlog, Mike Hine, myself, and there's another.
Will you have a cape?
No cape. What is with you in the cape?
I picture you the cape.
I have no cape.
I picture you like in these things, you know, they don't just call you Joe. They call you Lord Joe.
No. Okay. There is no cape. All right, go ahead. There is no cape. So,
And did you really, hung up on Chris twice?
Yeah, I did.
Chris, if you're listening, you know, I didn't know he did that.
Yes, you did. You were laughing.
I laughed the first time because you after he hung up, I said, who was that? And you go like, Chris. So, that's why I laughed.
But the first film of the festival is a film called Bereavement, and it's directed and written by Stephen Mena, who, by the way, is an alumni of the festival. The first year of the festival, he had a film that actually went on to get some nice distribution and stuff called Malevolence.
Okay.
And this is a prequel to it.
Prequel to Malevolence.
Yes. And one of the stars of the film is Michael Biehn.
Michael Biehn. And
yes.
So one of the stars of this film, Bereavement, is
yes.
Michael Biehn. Michael yeah. Biehn of the
Abyss.
Terminator, the Abyss. Aliens
yep.
2, or Aliens, I should say, which was Alien yeah. 2. Okay, Michael Biehn.
And he'll be calling in later.
So he's going to be here on the show?
He's going to be calling in and joining us.
My God.
And also the Lifetime Award recipient,
yes.
Robert Englund, will be joining us shortly.
The Robert Englund?
The Robert Englund.
Wow.
And you know what's really interesting is when you go back and look at his credits,
yes.
You know, everybody mostly recognizes him as Freddy Krueger. And
it's
in later
signature role.
And in later years, all the horror films he's done.
Right.
But when you go back and look, I mean, he's been in some major films.
Yes, he has. Yes, he has.
You know, and that's really impressive.
Well, you know, I really would like to talk to Robert Englund because he's had a very interesting career and... it's interesting to have a career in this genre because of what the genre is. I'm very curious as to what it is for him. And
he's directing now, too.
Really?
Yes.
I see. I would ask him all that.
And
all that.
We were actually... He was actually going to come in to promote a new film he's in called Incubus.
Okay.
But they were having some problems. They couldn't finish the film on time.
Okay.
So, of course,
So it couldn't be in the fest?
Couldn't be in the festival. Okay. Wasn't ready for public viewing. So, of course...
So, Englund has another film called Incubus about to come out?
Yes, right. That he's in. But, of course, if you're going to have him there and you're going to give him the Lifetime Achievement Award, what film are you going to show? And, of course, you're going to show...
The original.
Nightmare on Elm Street. Phone is ringing.
Oh, the thing. Phone is ringing. All right. Okay. Well, I just wanted to say that we have the tickets to give away, too. So I wanted to mention that.
Okay. Well, let's see.
Hello, you're on the air?
Yes.
Is this Chris?
Yeah.
All right. Chris is there. Bob, Joe hung up on you twice. But now, so stay there, Chris. Now, so what's the deal? Like, we have tickets right here that you can come down to the station right now to get
right.
for a screening of Skyline Thursday night at 11.
Right. And
yeah.
Either way to remember that, it's 11-11 at 11.
11-11 at 11.
Yes.
Wow. All right. So you want me to play this trailer? Because I think everybody's seen the trailer. I haven't seen the trailer. I don't even watch trailers anymore.
Chris, have you seen the trailer for Skyline?
Not yet, no.
There you go.
See, all right. Well, Chris,
he's
the last.
Other than me,
the
he's
last
the
man.
Other everyman.
Well, he's also, he represents 50%.
I would say he does.
How frightening.
I know.
Okay, well, you know.
Well, he's a
okay.
consumer of mass media.
True.
So if he hasn't seen it, then.
True.
Man, I'm just hurt right here, man.
That's okay. What, that just keep on bleeding. I'm not calling 911.
Joe, what's the matter, man?
He's just wearing black, and he's in that.
Why is Joe so sensitive?
He's not sensitive.
I'm
he's
not
just,
sensitive.
He's just evil. Mean.
I've never seen this side of Joe.
I see it all the time. Just so you know.
In real
life,
not over
there. It's a big side. It's a big side.
Well, you know, I just about the Robert Englund thing, you know.
Wait. I want to tell people how to get the tickets.
Oh, go ahead.
The tickets. Okay. The way to get the tickets is this. You can come down to the station at 120 Wall Street. And that's on the 10th floor. It's WBI. Come anytime between 9 and 5.
And
okay?
The tickets will be here.
And the tickets will be here. You know, you can reserve them in your name if you want to email us at lifeislikesciencefiction@gmail.com. And so, that's it. We have tickets for Skyline. 11 p.m. on Thursday. So keep that in mind. If you want to come get tickets, come get them. We got a limited amount, and that's it. But now, so Robert Englund may be here. Robert, are you there?
I am here.
Robert Englund, how are you?
Good evening. I'm good.
Wow.
I'm good. Be in your neck of the woods this week, next weekend.
Okay.
For the New York City Horror Festival.
That's pretty good. And they're going to give you a Lifetime Achievement Award.
They're giving me something, boy. I'll tell you, I'm looking forward to it. I've got some space on my shelf here, so I'll take whatever I can
understand.
Get.
Well, yeah. I have many questions I'd like to ask you, but
sure.
My first question to you is, when did you first know that this is what you wanted to do with your life, be a storyteller, be an actor?
Oh, gosh, I wish I could, you know, give you all sorts of artistic ramifications, but, seriously, my mother's best friend had a long-legged daughter who was absolutely drop-dead beautiful and a year ahead of me in school, and as I was entering that sort of traumatic shift between grammar school and what we used to call back in the day junior high school, which I think they term middle school now. I was going to use a bit of her popularity. She was the belle of the ball in junior high school, and I sort of hoped, because I had grown up with her, and even though I was younger than her, I was hoping to use her popularity to kind of ease my way into middle school. And the summer before, she sort of had to chaperone me. The moms were out a lot, the ladies who lunch, etc. And I hung out with her as she was a wannabe actress in a professional children's theater. And so I tagged along and figured that I would be an usher, or that I would build scenery. And in fact, I got all the starring roles. I was Aladdin. I was Pinocchio.
Wow.
I was Hansel and Hansel and Gretel. I was Peter Pan. And I remember in Pinocchio getting the same laugh every night in the same place. And it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of a rock star feeling. I mean, it's really hard to describe, but you really feel, you know, kind of godlike, because you can make it happen and make it repeat, and you kind of control all of those people out there in the dark. And I think that was the beginning glimmer of me really kind of craving that. I'm sure there's a lot of ego and a lot of needing to be loved as part of that. And then literally about a year later, in middle school, probably in an early pre-algebra class or something. I know it was a math class, and I was sitting in the back with my protractor drawing the answer column, which you had to do on the side of the school paper to put all your answers in.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I remember sitting there, and I was having so much trouble with whatever the quiz was or the classwork, and the back door was open, and I was at the end of a row, and I glanced out the back, and there were the girls at gymnasium in their short shorts and their starched blouses with their little collars up, and they were all doing archery. And it had just rained, and the hay bales with the targets on them, for the archery class, the smell of the wet hay came in the back door, and it smelled very similar to the backstage area that we had in the sort of summer stock children's theater. Something about the wet hay and the target smelled a lot like the scenery stored back there. And that had been the sort of romantic backstage place where we had, you know, teenage assignations and heavy petting, and it was also, you know, the literal backstage area of all of these great experiences I was having on stage. And that smell came in, and I was sitting there fudging my answer column, and I literally knew that day. And so I couldn't have been a day, I was probably 13, maybe 13 and a half years old, and I think that's the moment I really knew that's what I was going to do. I had such a longing and such a nostalgia, and I missed that.
Wow.
That past summer so much, you know, learning how to blow smoke rings in the girls' bathroom with all of the older girls that were in Aladdin's harem while they put spoolies in my hair to give it some curl.
Wow.
And I, all those memories came rushing back, you know, and I think I knew then for sure that that's what I was going to do. I shined my poor father on for years and letting him think I was going to be a lawyer until I decided not to go to Stanford and broke his heart until he saw the family name on screen in 1973 in Buster and Billy, and I think that his ego also reared its head, and he was so proud of seeing the family name on screen in a single title card. But that's it. That's really it. And you know, I look back on that time, and, you know, my first, I think one of the plays was Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and I was the lead dwarf, Doc, the head dwarf. And I'm not trying to be politically incorrect, but, you know, it is called Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, not Snow White and the Seven Little People. And I had to wear like, they put aluminum foil all over me and cotton to shape our face kind of, you know, troll-like. And then on top of that, they basted us with latex and false hair, crepe hair and everything. And so that was like literally my first big role. And that was makeup. And I remember around the same time, there was a coffee table book at my godfather's house. And I loved horror movies as a child. And I would look at all of the great stills. And there was a great still of Frankenstein with the little girl before he broke her neck and threw her in the lake. And there was a great still, I know, from Daughters of Dracula, where I swear I saw nipples underneath the wardrobe. And there was some great stills in the silent section before the Golden Age of Horror section. It was called Life Goes to the Movies. And there was a series of like postage stamp size stills, reduced of Lon Chaney in all of his variegated makeups, including one where he'd made himself look blind by boiling an egg and taking that little placenta underneath the shell and putting it over his eyeball to make it look all milky and blind. And I remember being obsessed with that for a year, year and a half of my life, and running into my godfather's office to look at that book every time I was dropped off at my godparents, when my parents would go to Vegas or something. And I look back now with a hindsight that we all have, and I realize that, and then I realize, you know, this, you know, playing one of the dwarfs with all of that makeup, and I can still smell that latex and an hour in the chair before curtain. And then my first film, Buster and Billy, for the wonderful director Daniel Petrie. My first film was a starring role. I'm looking at the poster in my office as I speak to you. In that movie also, I had to have my skin bleached, and I was an albino who dyed his hair black with shoe polish, and I had to, you know, I wound up wearing Alan Arkin's toupee from Catch 22 because I was supposed to have straight hair that looked like a 1940s crew cut, and I had contact lenses and that. So it's strange how, you know, over the years, even though I've done over 75 movies, you know, and I probably only wore makeup in maybe, I don't know, 12 of them, but still, you know, how that sort of influenced me, and there's some kind of like child fantasy thing going on there, you know, that harkens back to Ray Harryhausen and all of those guys, you know, and I think that's all. I had buried that all real deep when I became kind of a snobby actor in London and New York and in the theater, and I kind of buried all that stuff, and it's, you know, over the years it sort of leaked out, you know, and I realized that I think some of that stuff was really in there the day I said yes to Wes Craven.
Wow. I have to ask you then, at this point in your life and looking back the way you can now, do you feel that, you know, it was sort of meant to be, fate? Do you feel like it was divine?
I think there is something connected with it. You know, I was over doing a personal appearance a couple of years ago in Brussels. They have a wonderful film festival over there, and I'd been on the jury with Christopher Lee. And I was signing autographs at the film festival, and there was, you know, just a few dealers there, but they were very high-end, really kind of gourmet dealers, you know. And I remember there was a phenomenal Saul Bass poster for Anatomy of a Murder, which is one of my favorite movies, and there were some great French noirs and James Bond. Bond posters, you know, and I was looking at that. And then I found a 1954 original Walt Disney Belgian poster for 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea to Jules Verne. And that was a real seminal, and it all came rushing back to me, looking at this poster, which I don't know whether I'd seen it before, that it, where there had been part of in the old Fantasyland, in the original Disneyland. I think they had the original Nautilus from the film, the James Mason Kirk Douglas film there, and you could walk through it. And I remember that really, really got under my skin. And that was the first place I always went at Disneyland. And I may have seen that poster there, but it's so wonderful because, you know, all of the writing is in Belgian, and which is, you know, Jules Verne's native tongue. And so that makes it kind of great. And it's the original poster. But when I saw it and I looked at it, thumbing through, beyond the Otto Preminger and beyond the, you know, the American noirs as conceived by, you know, French graphic artists in the 40s and 50s, early 50s, and, you know, past the James Bond, the cool James Bond poster, I remember all of these memories coming back about the giant squid and the suction marks on the sailors' faces, you know, as they come up through the hold, you know, in the diving chamber after the squid is attacked, and how much that meant to me. And it was sort of like layers and layers of classical training and snobism were being worn away, and I was back to some real primal Robert Englund that had really, really influenced me, along with, you know, seeing a re-release of King Kong and the original Frankenstein uncut on the Late Show back in the 50s at a sleepover at a friend's house. And so I really do think that there was a certain kind of karmic steering going on that has, you know, wound up leading me a sort of road company Vincent Price, Klaus Kinski, whatever, if you will, you know, that I have become kind of inadvertently and through no manipulation or design of my own, but nevertheless, that's sort of how I've wound up now, and I kind of, you know, I kind of have embraced it.
Wow. Now, let me ask you personally, in all seriousness, getting an award like this, which is kind of a lifetime achievement, which embraces everything that you've done and how many people have enjoyed, you know, your work and your being scared by you and all the characters you've played. How do you feel getting an award like this?
Well, you know, I'm real lucky, and I think a lot of it is just this strange sort of perfect storm that happened to me. I was right on the cusp. I'd done 12 or 15 movies, but I was right on the cusp of the Virgin Video, revolution, MTV, cable, and then DVDs, and now Blu-ray, and Netflix, and all of that. And so I sort of stumbled into almost three generations now of fans, you know, and the Nightmare on Elm Street films and the sort of iconic status of the character Freddy Krueger. It's now become almost a litmus test or a kind of, something that may almost sort of come of age. I'm certainly younger now than when the original movie came out, but there is this glorious box set, and it is sort of this classic American horror movie now that is it's certainly more contemporary than the Wolfman and Dracula and Frankenstein, and so it is sort of entered the kind of vernacular, you know, as this horror movie. And so I'm very fortunate to have had that happen, with all those other factors that I mentioned, the video, the DVD, the Netflix, the cable, where constantly new fans can discover you. And also the fact that horror, like action films, really travels well. You know, they're universal. And so since the early 80s, I've had, you know, huge, huge fan base overseas as well, which is kind of nice. So, I'm those factors, they're the reason, I think, that Freddy Krueger character is so well known. I'd love to take credit for it, but certainly the credit has to go to Wes and his idea and a little bit of torment he felt as a child with his brother one night when this old man caught his eye when his parents were out for dinner and looked at him through the curtains. Probably the stimulus and the origin of Freddy Krueger in Wes's subconscious. So, you know, I'm real happy, you know, to be acknowledged as the sort of logo for that experience, you know, and it's always amazing to me to see just how universal it is.
Well, Robert Englund, I want to thank you for spending all this time with us here.
I'm great. I'm glad, and I hope to see some fans this coming weekend in Manhattan. We're going to be talking and Q&A-ing, and I'm really looking forward to it. I'm glad to have had some time to talk to you.
Could have been an assistant. One more question. You're going to be here for the entire festival? Because we have the festival director, Mike Hine, is here. He wants to say
hey, Robert.
Hey, Mike.
How are you, man?
How are you?
I'm doing real good. You getting ready? Getting psyched for a good time in New
ready.
York?
Yeah, I'm flying in Wednesday. I have a little bit of business to do, and I'll see you guys all weekend.
Because we are going to show you and Nancy one hell of a good time, I can tell you that.
Okay, I'm looking forward to it.
And I got to say, with all due respect to what you were just saying, and with due respect to Wes Craven, who is one of my favorite filmmakers, no doubt about it, and yes, he may have created Freddy, but I think anybody listening, anybody that ever watched any of the Nightmare movies knows that he may have created that character, but you made that character. And you look back on it now and you go...
I mean, I'm not being that humble by it. I know there's contributions and there's energy, and I know there's also mistakes were made. In various incarnations and sequels, but you know, I mean, and I know I brought a certain body language and energy and I kind of ran
the way
with
you
a sense of humor.
One-liner. Come on.
Well, I ran with a sense of humor, you know, and I think, but that's also, you know, again, that's if it hadn't been for Wes Craven and Sam Raimi, really understanding that horror could take an element of satire and self-reference and comedy, and really also use that as creators and directors to alleviate the kind of nervous tension that occurs when you're in an audience in the dark for 90 minutes and of humor that you get there, which is you can release the tension.
Yes, hello.
Set people up for a scare.
Hi, I have Michael Biehn calling in.
Michael Biehn, we're ready to bring him in. Robert,
all right.
We've got Michael Biehn coming in. I want to thank you for
all
being
right.
with us.
All right, and give my best to Michael.
All right, well, you want to stay a second and say hello?
No, I've actually got company here, so I've got to go back and entertain, but I'll see everybody.
Rock and roll, Robert. We'll see you this weekend.
You,
we're looking
okay,
forward to it.
Give my best to Michael. Bye-bye.
Okay. Michael Biehn, are you there?
Yeah, it's me.
Hey, Michael, how are you?
I'm good. How are you? Who am I talking
Johnny
to?
Ringo. This is Johnny Ringo.
This is Mike Sargent. this is Mike Sargent here. I'm here with Joe Massiri, and Mike Hine is also here in the studio with us.
Hi, Mike. And who, Sargent?
I'm Mike Sargent. That's right.
Mike Sargent. All right. Well, hello, guys. Are you a radio station in New York City?
Yes, we are. We're WBAI.
In Manhattan?
Yep.
In Manhattan. Great. Well, good for you guys, man. Good for you. Congratulations. You're working, man.
So are you, man. We just saw Bereavement, you know, when we were going through the selection process. Have you actually seen the final cut, Steven's final cut of the film?
No, I haven't seen it. Actually, no, man. I think that when I looped, the last time I talked to Steven about it, we were doing some looping over the telephone. And, you know, he was asking me to add lines and, you know, or change the lines. And I think we did it over the telephone. So I know that he had some reshoots and some trials and tribulations, but I'm glad he's finally gotten it out because I like Steve a lot. And
yes,
I certainly liked his first movie. And that's why I did it, because I liked his first movie so much. But it had a lot of style, and I think he's got a lot of style, and so I look forward to seeing it.
Yeah, I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised. First off, you're absolutely solid in this film, the film itself is just such a cut above your, you know, it could have been so easy for Steve to make a slasher, gore fest, you know, the lowest common denominator, just go for it. But Steven's the type of filmmaker who took this story and really made it a solid, you know, creepy, serious film. It's not a film that anybody's going to take campy or cheesy or, you know, it's a really strong film. The cast in it, everybody from Michael to the entire cast is just amazing.
All right. Well, Michael, I have to ask you now. I'm the film critic here at WBAI, so I'm very curious to see the film. What's the name of the character you play?
I don't know. I don't remember.
I love it.
Tell me.
I'll give you a quick rundown.
Okay, give me a quick rundown.
Quick rundown.
Okay.
I know I played her father. How about that?
Okay.
The story.
That's not a player. Uncle, my girlfriend telling me.
The story is about a serial killer who actually abducts a child, a small boy, and he, not to do anything crazy to the kid or to kill the kid, his idea is to make this child sit and watch every murder, every crazy, insane, disgusting thing that this scumbag does. He's going to make this child watch. Right. And that's
the concept of the film.
It's a prequel to his first film. So this was the killer in
Malevolence.
The killer in the first film is the little kid in this film, which takes place in the 70s or the 80s. And Michael plays the father of, like, it's hard to say Final Girl, because it's really not that kind of slasher horror film. It's really not. It's much smarter than that. And she, for one reason or another, comes to live with him and his family, which immediately puts him and his family in danger, so on and so forth. And the story just rolls from there.
Does that sound familiar to you, Michael?
Kind of, yeah.
All right. Well, and that's going to be part. When does that play at the film festival, Mike?
That is actually our opening night film. It is the opening night is the party, which is kicking ass. I know that Michael wanted to be there, but I heard he just had surgery. What happened out there in L.A.? Playing a little football?
No.
Fight with the Terminator?
A hernia. I had a hernia operation.
Oh, that sucks.
Fighting too many cyborgs.
You know, actually, it wasn't too bad. It was, just a little cut, and then I had to stay over in the hospital just because they wanted to keep the antibiotics in me running for a day or two. So,
well,
it wasn't really too big of a deal. So.
I got to tell you,
we're
going to miss you here at the festival, and I promise the next one you're in that gets in, we're flying your butt in. But I got to say, you probably dodged a bullet. Because you'd get my father and my older brother cornering you, just talking every goddamn line from Tombstone to you.
Well, you know, that was a fun movie to make, Tombstone.
You know what? It looks like you guys had a good time with it.
I've got a couple movies that I've just done that maybe next year we'll have at your festival, that would be nice. And one's called The Divide. And that's Xavier Jens, who did Frontiers. He's the French guy that Luc Besson took under his...
We are very familiar with his work.
And he did a movie called The Divide. I'm telling you, man, this movie that I did for him, I just saw it a couple of days ago. It is absolutely outrageous, man. It is outrageously good. I mean, it's good, but it's outrageous. And I don't know exactly who's going to buy it and when they're going to buy it, but it's going to get seen and it's going to get talked about. A bunch of people that are in a bomb shelter, and they kind of have to Lord of the Fly sort of thing. You know, they kind of have to, you know, survival of the fittest as the food's running out, and you know, and the violence and the rape and the murder and the pillaging and shit that goes on down there. It's really, really a bizarre piece, and some great people in it. Milo Ventimiglia is in it. Michael Eklund is a great Canadian actor, and Rosanna Arquette. And it's really, really good, but it's kind of in that vein of a horror, I would say, like a horror movie. And then one that I just directed called The Victim is kind of a horror movie. I did something that was kind of a grindhouse type of thing, just kind of in honor of Robert Rodriguez, who put me in his grindhouse movie.
Right.
I decided, you know, after I did The Divide, that I was just going to go make a grindhouse movie, and to myself, what do I need? I need some hot chicks. I need some dirty cops, some dope, some violence, some action, and what the hell's run a serial killer? So I fucking wrote it, and got my girlfriend to produce it for me, and she stars in it with me, and she got her girlfriend, Danielle Harris, who's kind of a
We just did a screening with Danielle. Yeah. She's a lot of fun, right?
I just interviewed her.
Danielle's great. She's in the movie, and and we just went out and shot it. Shot it in 11 days.
Wow.
And we were doing 36, 38 setups a day, and anyway, it's
so when are we going to get to see this? What's that? First off,
well,
what's the title?
Well, right now I just walked the rough cut on this, so I've got to go in and I've got to put music to it, which I don't know very much about. So I'm talking to composers right now, and then I've got to go in and have a sound supervisor and a sound guy, basically, you know, put all the sound effects in and I'll do all the sound. What do they call it?
Foley.
Foley, but they call it post sound design. That sounds better than just Foley, you know. Foley always to me sounds like two guys with a cans clacking them together. But you know, sound design, and you know, it's a first for me, as was the editing process. But grindhouse, man.
As like a major actor who has been in some of the biggest blockbusters of the last two decades. How did you find directing and getting behind the camera and the whole process? Did you enjoy it, or are you over it?
I'm a madman. I'm crazy. I'm like, you know, people ask me about Jim Cameron and how difficult he is. They ask me about Michael Bay, how difficult he is, how William Friedkin, how difficult, how much he yells, and so on and so forth. I'm worse. I was worse than all of them. All three of them put together. I spent the entire time making this movie screaming. I'm like a half drill sergeant, you know, half like football coach. Like, you know, just, and I'm crazy. I'm absolutely deranged when I'm directing. And I don't know where it comes from, but I don't fire anybody. Nobody got fired. And I don't yell specifically and call people names or anything like that, but I yell a lot because things don't get done right or they're not getting done on time.
Oh, I hear that.
And so I got what I wanted, and I think I got some good performances, and I think the movie's going to look beautiful. We shot it day for night because I saw Frontiers, which was Xavier's movie when I was doing The Divide. I said, Xavier, how did you get that night in your movie, man? It looks incredible. That's just so cool looking. How did you get that? And he goes, oh, I see you. Michael, I shoot it day for night. And I always thought day for night was like crap. There's stuff in cowboy movies and stuff. And I didn't know that you could create a night that looked as visual as you can these days. And so I thought, okay, well, I'm going to do that. So we shot this day for night.
Oh,
and,
so it's got that sort of
concrete
look to it.
Exactly.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I love that when it's used correctly.
Yeah. And it is. We shot it that way, and I've got it at a house that when I went in originally to the post house before we started shooting. I said, we're going to use these cameras, and can you give me Frontiers? And they looked at it, and they said, yeah. So we'll have that for night. There's a lot of flashbacks, and Danielle's in all the flashbacks. So we have some day-to-day stuff in it, but most of it takes place at night. And it's a crazy story. It's a wild story, man. It's meant to be like in the old days, like the B movie, you know, that comes in. You know, it's very exploitive. I just tried to everything that I could possibly exploit. I threw in there, and it's all in there, and. I think it's fun, you know. There's a nod to Quentin, and a nod to Robert, and a nod to Clint Eastwood in it, who are my favorite directors. And I had a blast with it. So,
bug has bit you, the directing bug. So even though you screamed and yelled, the bug has bit you. You enjoyed the whole process.
I like being an actor better, man. Actually, I like.
Oh yeah, of course. You actors, you get to come to stage.
I like showing up and just going like, "Where's my trailer? Where are we doing? Is that the big one over there? Oh no, the smaller one. Okay.
Where's my coffee?
All right, let me know. yeah. Where's my coffee? All right, call me in a couple hours for makeup. I'm crazy. I'm 54 now. It takes a lot out of me, man. If it's my name and my, you know, face, and like if I'm directing it, my name is on it as a director, then, you know, it better not look stupid. And, you know, when I'm acting, that's all I have to worry about is my character and my character not looking stupid. And I had, you know, I go around and around sometimes with directors in the old days, you know, because I didn't want to look stupid as an actor. Well, when you're directing, you got to make sure that everything doesn't look stupid, from the sets to the wardrobe to the makeup to the you know, to the background
and
to the shot.
Everyone's looking at you for the answers.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I have none of the answers, but I have a lot of like a lot of BS, I guess, you know. I felt like I act like I know what I'm doing, and I think it inspires people that think that, like, wow, he yells a lot. He, somebody asks me a question, I have an answer for him immediately, and I think that they think I know what I'm doing, you know. So I think I'm just kind of getting over on people, but I'm happy with the movie. I think it's gonna be cool. And It's a horror movie too.
Well,
it's
I'll tell you what, when you're ready to start promoting this thing hard, you have your people get in touch with us, and we'll definitely, whether it's, I doubt it'll be another year before the festival before you're ready to start showing it. But we do, at the New York City Horror Film Festival, we do events and screenings all year long. And that's something that the listeners should know anyway. So you guys should get in touch with us, and we can, you know, this is the world's largest media and market out here. I mean, L.A. is nice, but... You know, it's not New York City.
I'll definitely get in touch with you, because I'm going to have it done in 6 weeks. And, hold on a second. What? We need your email, though.
All right, I'll get you. NYCHorrorFest.com, and it's going to go straight
to me. Hold on a second. Here, Jen.
Hi.
Hey, Jen, how are you?
Good.
It's the producer.
And this is one of the stars. What is this, one of the stars of the film?
Yes, this is Jennifer Blanc.
There you go. I was going to say, give us your last name, but she's an actress. Absolutely. In L.A. She knew that already. Outstanding.
Yeah, I know how to do it. okay, I'm going to put your email in right now, and you'll get, like, a link to the site and everything.
Sweet.
Okay, go.
NYC Horror Fest.
NYC?
Horror Fest.
Best?
At AOL.
NYC Horror Fest.
At AOL. And while you're there, you can check, it's nychorrorfest.com is the website for the whole festival.
Okay.
You guys are missing. I'm so upset that he had that hernia operation. I'm telling you.
I know. It was intense for him. I mean, he's doing great.
No,
but,
I know. I'm glad he's feeling better. Yeah, pain meds will definitely float you through the day.
Okay, I'm going to put him back on, and I'm going to send you an email, and maybe you can check if you get it right now, so you know how to get a hold of us.
Well, I'm not going to be home until about 3-4 a.m. Remember, it's already...
Oh, excuse me, am I allowed to say that?
No, but I think they believed you. That's okay.
You're in my city. That's where I grew up.
Where are you from?
New York City.
No,
where? Mount Sinai Hospital.
Oh,
yeah,
Manhattan. So Manhattan, nice.
Upper East Side, 80th and Madison.
Manhattanite.
But my mom's from the Bronx.
Much love for the Bronx, too.
Yeah, you're from the Bronx?
Oh, no. I was born in Manhattan, a little bit of raising out in Brooklyn, a little bit of raising out in Jersey. So I'm a tri-state area guy.
Tri-state area. Awesome. All right, here's Beanie. Hold on.
So listen, man, it's not really a horror movie per se, like those type of things. Like hopefully, like you said, Steven's done a kind of cool thing with his thing. Ours isn't a horror per se, but you know it is scary and it does have a serial killer in it.
Yeah, no, but
I think we're gonna try to premiere it at South by Southwest and at the
WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Look, our festival is running next week. I mean, this week. It's Wednesday,
week.
So it's obviously, I mean, if you want to throw us out a trailer and could overnight it, I'll screen it during like, the bereavement screening or a couple of places.
I can't get a trailer because I don't have a trailer because I haven't got it colorized yet.
Wait, man. What I'm saying is when you're ready to start showing it, it doesn't have to be at the festival. What Joe Masuri here does, and what I do through the festival's name, is we do a lot of promotions for all kinds of films.
Lots
of stuff. So we it doesn't have to be a horror film for it to get a line around the block,
Michael,
especially if Mike Sargent puts his name behind it.
All right, since there are three Michaels here, and believe it or not, you are still tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI 99.5 FM. And it is still Night Shift, believe it or not. But Michael Biehn, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I feel like I've gotten to know you here, like we're sitting around the table and I'm watching you two guys talk.
Without the beers.
But I only have one question for you.
Yeah.
Do you love what you're doing?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I do. You know, I always have. But I love it too much. And it's kind of a problem with not women. Jennifer's heard just yell from the sidelines. I love it too much. You know, I care about it too much. People have always told me that all my life. And so I'm very, very passionate about it. But people have a tendency to think that I'm intense and that I'm angry and that I get too intense about it, and they can't handle the intensity. I care too much. But yeah, I care. I care. And I like it. I enjoy it. But it's like a sport. It's like going out and playing a game of football or going out and playing a game of racquetball or whatever. While you're doing it, it's hard work, and it's afterwards, you know, you walk away from a day's work or a good game of racquetball or a good game of 1-on-2-on-2 in basketball, and you go, yeah, I feel pretty good about that. Yeah, I still got it, you know. So I still enjoy it, definitely. Definitely. And unless I have to do something that I don't want to do, which I have in the past, you know, to pay the bills for my four children that I have. You know, sometimes I've had to act in things that I didn't really want to act in just to pay the bills. And that doesn't happen very often. That hasn't happened in a while. But I made some stupid choices in the past. But if it's a script that I like and a character I like, I love it. I love walking away at the end of the day going, yeah, I still got it. Yeah, I can still hang with the boys.
And any dream project or dream role yet that you're still looking forward to doing?
No, man. You know, there is no, like, you know, there's not dream roles or dreams. I like working with the people that are the best, you know. I'd love to work for Spielberg. I'd love to work for Clint Eastwood. I'd love to work for Woody Allen. I'd love to work for Darren. I'd love to work for, you know, it's so many people out there. It's the good, those Cameron again, you know, Rodriguez again, Quentin, those guys, man, they're just so fun to be around, and they're just also brilliant. And I mean, Robert and Quentin are just like so fun to make movies with, you know. They just love making movies, and it's fun, man. It's fun with them. It's really fun with them. And Cameron's just so brilliant to be around, and you know, guys, I've worked with Michael Bay, I've worked and worked with Friedkin, who's crazy but brilliant also. And so it's really working with people more than it is like a project. If you said like that's what would I want, I'd want to do another movie with Jim, I want to do another movie with Robert, another one with Friedkin, another one with Michael Bay, another one, you know, work with those guys, you know. That's what I would want to do. I don't think of like, oh, there's this role, romantic leading, you know, oh, I want to do a comedy where I, you know, but I like to work with those guys again, you know, because they make it fun.
I hear you. And we do have another co-host who's on the phone. Chris, did you have any questions for Michael Biehn?
You know, Michael, I mean, at this point in your life, having would this be the first directorial thing that you've done? I mean,
well, actually, I got offered to direct a movie last year over in China. It's called Blood Bond, and it's a movie that I said that I would do because they said they were going to pay me, and they were going to pay me pretty good, and they did. They paid me, but when I went over there to shoot the movie, which some friends of mine wrote, it wasn't in Beijing, and it wasn't in Shanghai. It was some studio about 2 hours outside of Guangzhou, and there was nobody there that really knew how to make a movie. And
wow.
So, you know, I kind of had to make the movie on my own. There was me, there was a DP who had some experience at, because he had shot a couple of, he worked with a guy named Ringo Lam before, and he was a good DP, so I had him. And, Jennifer was out there, she worked as an actress on the show, but most of all the actors were brand new and fresh. I didn't have an AD, I didn't have a line producer, I didn't have set dressers, I didn't have, I had, you know, it was an action movie, but I couldn't shoot off blanks, I couldn't shoot squibs, I couldn't use squibs,
So you made the Blair Witch Project.
What's that?
You made the Blair Witch Project, basically.
I did what I could, man. I basically, you know, I directed something with both hands tied behind my back. And then after I was finished with it, the producer didn't, I don't know why, whether he didn't have the money or he just decided would he wanted to do it or whatever. I came back to L.A. He said he was going to bring it to L.A. and let me, you know, edit it and do what I'm doing with The Victim right now. And he didn't. He kept it. And I don't even think he hired an editor. I think he just edited it himself and you know, that upset me. And so, you know, I got back in. Yeah, there were some problems on that. So I know the sound was really bad on it. They needed me to do looping on it, but they turned out it wasn't a Screen Actors Guild project. I was told that it had been a Screen Actors Guild project.
Once again,
and
you got four kids to feed.
Yeah. What's that?
I said, once again, you got kids to feed.
I have four kids to feed. So I consider that. I consider The Victim as being like my directorial debut. Maybe my, could be my last.
Well, that's what I was going to say. On your film here that you did, what was, okay, out of all the trials and tribulations, what was like a moment, or were there moments that you can recollect right now that were just incredible? You just were like, wow, that are like still going to stay with you. I mean, positive, like an incredible.
You know,
I'm still waiting for that moment.
You know, I mean, I tell you what, I think probably more than anything else for me is being able to get a performance from an actor. In this case, it was Ryan Honey. Ryan is a kid that's worked. He's not a kid; he's probably 40 or whatever, but he's 33. He's 33, and he's. You know, he's worked and he's done some episodic and worked some soap operas and stuff. But I believe that, you know, I was able to really like yank this performance out of him, and to watch him blossom underneath my, you know, kind of coaching, I would say, you know, was, I would say, more satisfying than anything that I've ever done as an actor, really, is to be able to pull something out of somebody that they couldn't have done without you. And I know that he couldn't have done it without me. And he would say so too. And it's funny. He's great in it. I think he's like absolutely brilliant in the movie, you know. But I mean, it's all a little, like I said, it's Grindhouse. It's all a little over the top. He's the antagonist. He's the bad guy. And, you know, you'll see when you see it. But yeah, that to me was probably the best moment I had in the movie. It was a few times that I got him in this space where he really needed to be.
Awesome. Well, thank you. You know, I want to just, you know, thank you for the pleasure of being able to even ask you these questions and being the backdrop of my life and everyone's life of, you know, I grew up watching you, you know, and you've just been an outstanding, incredible inspiration as an actor on the screen. And
thank you.
Yeah.
That's very nice of you to say.
That's old man. Johnny Ringo, man. Johnny Ringo.
Johnny Ringo is a great role, man. They don't come around very often.
It's,
but,
listen,
the
final scene, the showdown between you and Kilmer,
It's
honestly, now, the film's campy, you know, as a Western. It's got its camp factor, and it's got, but that particular scene with the back and forth where, you know, when he whacks you finally, I mean, it's got to be one of the best showdowns ever put in a Western, ever. That particular sequence there has got to go down. The dialogue between the two, the chemistry you guys had, you, like, really got it that you guys hated each other, and you were insane, and he was dying. It was just fabulous, man. Just outstanding.
Well, hey, Joe, don't you have a great question for Mike?
I've been here just, you know, writing it and taking it all in. I ask questions all the time, unlike you, Chris, who live up in the mountains. So, you know, it's great to have somebody who sits around thinking all day coming up with these thoughtful, provocative questions.
Well, nobody asked me a question, but I, you know, you guys got it right. I was crazy, and he was dying. And, you know, Val is the guy that I worked pretty closely with on that movie, and we spent a day or two rehearsing that sequence by ourselves out there a day before that we shot it, probably six, 8 hours rehearsing it and deciding how we were going to play it, because we could have played it any way we wanted to. And the standard way of doing that, obviously, in a gunfight is two guys who are standing like 15 feet away from each other, 20 feet away from each other.
You guys are literally two feet from each other.
Exactly. Well, and that's what made, and then we started coming up with this idea of kind of like moving and turning at the same time where we were circling each other. And that's kind of what really made that piece work. And of course the dialogue, and my favorite moment in the movie for Johnny Ringo, one of my favorite moments of my acting career, as you would call it, or whatever, is when he says, you know, I say my fight's not with you, and he says whatever he says is I beg to differ.
He says,
my fight's with you.
Yeah, he says we started a game we never got to finish. That's the line.
And then I get that twinkle in my eye, and then I say, all right, Lunger, let's do it. And that twinkle in my eye is that twinkle of like. That thrill of one of being like on the edge, and that's why people, you know, jump out of planes, and that's where they join the army, and that's where they, you know, fight, and that's why they, you know, that thrill of like, you know, almost like wanting to die. I thought Johnny was kind of like almost suicidal. It was almost like suicide by cops. It was almost like, okay, this is the moment. That's the moment. And there was a joy in that moment. There was this incredible joy in that moment. And that's what made Johnny Ringo so cool. But, you know, the thing about Johnny Ringo, just so you know, as your listeners know, because I would talk about him up to his aunt.
WBAI, New York. 99.5 FM.
But there was never any priest that was shot. And so that was crap. Johnny Ringo never killed anybody, never shot anybody. He was known for calling out Earth on the street and threatening him and saying, you know, let's have a fight, let's have a shootout. And Earp backed down, but he never shot anybody. He never killed anybody. If you look at history, so from a stance, I just like to point that out, because in reality, you know, the Earps went down there and they took out those guys, and there was an inquiry whether or not they were going to be charged for murder back then, and it was a big deal back then whether or not the Earps were going to be charged for murder. This revisionist history that the Earps were these heroes and the Cowboys were these bad guys. There's really kind of a lot of crap, really, you know. And if you go back and read the history, it's pretty interesting, because Wyatt Earp was no hero.
Yeah, neither film, Costner's film or your film, didn't get it exactly right. And you know, being a big history buff myself,
you know who did get it exactly right?
Who's that?
Not that, but he got it right, was Clint Eastwood, and that's The Unforgiven. To me, that's the best Western
of
all time.
I agree with you. It's probably the strongest Western ever made. That or Josie Wales.
Another one. I actually think Josie Wales is even better.
Josie Wales is a good one.
That's
man.
A great
We
film.
Got us a Josie Wales.
We got us a Josie Wales. I'm just such a Clint Eastwood fan.
Correct.
It's not even funny.
Yeah, I agree.
Such
I
a
agree.
Clint
well,
fan.
Well said.
All right, let me ask you a question, though, Michael, because this occurs to me. Now, because you've done so much genre work, you've done, you know, science fiction, obviously, you've done horror, and you've done Western. You were on the Western series for a couple of years, The Magnificent Seven. Do you have a favorite genre? Do you have favorite things about each genre? Things that you are enjoying getting to do? Being in it, I would have to assume, getting to play dress up.
No, man. I like playing what most people consider bad guys. You know, because I like rationalizing why people are the way they are, and I like making them heroes in my mind, and that's why I so vehemently still feel strongly that the Earps were in the wrong and the Earps should have been tried for murder, you know, because I get the reading and the history and I feel that like they were a bunch of bums, you know, and that's kind of what I enjoy doing. But as far as genre goes, as far as like science fiction or horror or, you know, whatever, no. I you know, as long as it's a good role, you know, if it's a role that I can have fun with, like this one I did for Xavier is just is another great role. This is the best role I've had in like 10 years. And
what's the film?
And my, it's called The Divide.
Oh, The Divide. Divide. Okay, right.
Yeah, and they are right in the end of post production now too. And I saw. Still had a couple effects to be put in. They'll have it done in about 6 weeks, and I don't know who they're going to sell it to and who's going to buy it or whatever, but it's going to make some noise, and it's the best role.
So they didn't make the market then? The market just ended, right? AFM just ended?
AFM, they didn't make AFM, no. They did not. But
well, his stuff is guaranteed to sell. It's not in question. I mean, his next film is guaranteed to sell. It's all a question of how large it goes out.
Guaranteed to fail?
Sell.
Oh, sell.
It's guaranteed to sell. It's guaranteed to get some kind of theatrical. And if the film is as strong as you're saying it is, you're going to get a wide release on it.
It is. Well, I would hope so. You just don't know these days what, you know, people are watching and stuff. But, I mean, it seems to me,
true.
Man, I was watching it, and it's like, I mean, it's 10 people in a room for 2 hours, so, or an hour, and whatever it is.
It's kind of like the show.
Minutes, you know, so, well, I don't know. I'm not there with you, but I don't know. After watching this, I don't know if you guys go to quite the depths that we go to in the movie, but if you do, it would be an interesting studio, that's for sure.
Well, I tell you, I'm pumped. Just you talking, just the way you talk about the film, I mean, I'm pumped for both your feature and this new thing.
Yeah,
I'm definitely down. Yeah. And let me ask you another question about The Victim. You wrote that too, right?
I did write it, yeah. I did, actually. There was a story that was a script, kind of a script novella that a guy by the name of Reed Lackey sent me months previously. And I read it at the time and kind of thought, well, this is, you know, not something that I'm interested in doing or putting any time and effort into, because there was no money behind it and there was nobody, you know, that was going to pay me to do anything with it. And, but I had looked at it, at Jennifer made me read it, and actually I thought somebody had some money at the time, and so I did read it, and I kind of thought, well, I don't know. And then it turned out the money fell apart. And so when I decided I was going to make this Grindhouse movie, I thought to myself, well, what can I do? And I remembered that script, and it kind of has the foundation and the characters. It was a page one rewrite, but he created the foundation and the characters and the story of that piece. Reed Lackey did, and he is, you know, without Reed Lackey, that movie never would have been made. And I just wrote the screenplay. Really, I just wrote the screenplay for it. So. I changed it to where I could have all of these kind of what I call grindhouse, you know, exploitive sort of sexual situations, dirty cop kind of serial kill. Well, he had a serial killer. His was more of your basic kind of hostile sort of serial killer type of, you know, like the script that you would like normally think of as a horror movie, you know. And it was his story, and I wrote the screenplay.
Michael Biehn.
So wait, are you in it?
Yeah, of course I'm in it, man. I'm the star of it, man.
Right,
I'm
course.
The star of it.
Well, because you keep talking about Eastwood, and I think Eastwood recently said, you know, hitting, I know, obviously, we're talking about a guy who's 75 years old, but he said he's getting
80. 80.
Is he 80? He just
80.
Had his 80?
He turned 80 this
year.
Well,
okay.
God bless him, man. God bless him. But what he said is he says, like, when he makes his films, you know, he never goes in looking for a role for himself anymore.
Right,
in the Bronco Billy days, that might have been a little different.
No,
but he said he would rather just be behind the camera. Yeah. But since he's producing these films independently now, he's kind of like, well, all right, I'll play this role.
This is the only way that I could get the money to even make this movie, you know. And believe me, we didn't spend very much money on it. And like I said, we shot it in 11 days, okay? And we were doing like 36 sets. But when you think of 36 or 38 setups a day, that's moving a camera from one spot to another spot and shooting a shot, you know, and you can do it 38 times in one day.
That's a lot of setup.
I'll tell you, I'm no actor. That's for sure. But I have directed 3 feature films, and I take my hat off to any person that can actually be, you know, work within the film, work out behind the camera, in front of the camera. But yet it seems to work time and time again, usually. I mean, I've seen some bad ones, too. I mean, me and Joe sit through a lot of crap at the festival.
Well, this is fun. There's no doubt about it. This is fun, and it is it's easy for me to do. I was not like, from an acting standpoint, it's like almost like I put myself on autopilot, and I'm directing it, and then the character is like on autopilot. It's just part of me, and I can go from behind the camera to in front of the camera just as quickly as I saw a special. You guys might have seen it on Eastwood before, and it's like a documentary or some footage on him, and they show him basically directing himself when he's dragging himself out of the bar after he's got the shit kicked out of him by Gene Hackman.
Right.
And he's dragging himself out, and before it.
WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM.
And all of a sudden he's like action, and he's like, and then he just stands up and goes, okay, cut, how'd it look? Look good? Okay, fine, cut, and that's the way it is. I mean, that's what acting is. It's not like people say, like, oh, how did you stay in character, or, is it hard to get out of character? It's like, what? What are you talking about? It's acting, for God's sakes, I mean,
It's the old story about Olivier and Hoffman. When they made the Marathon Man, he would run around the block before the scene 5 times and then come in all out of breath, and Olivia would be like, well, why don't you just act?
I tell you what, though, Hoffman is, I watched about, I fell asleep on it, but I watched about the first 30 minutes of Marathon Man last night.
Oh, really?
And the great John Schlesinger, probably his best movie. And there's some great stuff in that. I forgot at the beginning of the movie, before Olivier is even in it, Roy Scheider's in it.
Oh,
Roy Scheider looks like $1 million in it. I worked with him, but he's great in it. And then I had forgotten. It's a really well done movie. And Dustin Hoffman is, along with, Pacino and De Niro is, that generation's, and Nicholson's, there's about five actors, and he's one of them for sure, one of the great ones.
I saw that movie as a little kid.
However you can get there, whether you're Laurence Olivier, whether you have to run around the block, or you don't run around the block, if you can get to what Dustin Hoffman gets to, then
do it.
But for me in this movie, it was just, it's fun. I can't wait for people to see it.
Quick little anecdote about Dustin Hoffman. Me and Joe are standing outside of a screening at the Tribeca Film Festival, and one of the films that was actually submitted to the festival, our festival, New York City Horror Festival, and got in. So we're going into the screening, and we're standing outside, and the cast and the crew of the film, the name of the film is Ticked Off Trannies with Knives. It's about a bunch of transvestites that get beat up by this, scumbag, and they get their revenge on the guy. It's a comedy. It's hysterically funny. It's a definitely blue film that's a lot of fun. But as me and Joe are standing there, Dustin Hoffman comes walking out of one of the other Tribeca screenings, and he comes walking right past us, and, people are asking him for his autograph, but I'm not going to ask this guy for his autograph. So he's getting to a cab, and his buddy's hailing a cab, and I look over him, and I said, hey, Dustin, you're not going to hang around to see Ticked Off Trannies with Knives? And he looks at me like I'm an absolute ass. And I look at him.
Can't imagine.
And I look at him and I go, and he thinks I'm lying. Like, he thinks I'm just being a jerk, right? And I point up to the marquee, and and he sees Ticked Off Trannies with Knives. He can't believe that that's actually a film, which is screening at the festival this year. The only reason I bring it up. So he looks at his buddy and he goes, the kid's not lying. He's like, what do you think? And they're like, then a cab pulls up and they just got in the cab and went. But it shows that Ted Hoffman's a pretty good guy anyway.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, Michael Bean, I thoroughly enjoy having you here, and I'm amazed that you're giving us the amount of time that you are. But thank you.
I got nothing else to do, man. You're welcome. You're welcome.
He's convalescing, man. He just can't have surgery. He's convalescing.
Yeah.
Convalescing in the air. Well,
you guys, best of luck with your film festival. And like I said, I will send you, if you guys promote movies, you'll hear from me in the future.
No, definitely do. I'm not kidding.
We'll get you a Mike Sargent quote.
Yeah.
My favorite Dustin Hoffman movie? Straight Time.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That's a very
right?
good one.
I'm actually even a fan of Ishtar. That's right. I said it.
I like Tootsie. I like Tootsie.
Oh,
Pollock.
Yeah, I know you guys are trying to get rid of me. I'm going to get rid of myself.
No, we're not.
All right.
We're not. All right. Thank you, Michael Bean. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
So just because we've been talking about this for the last hour and 20 minutes, or at least hour and 10 minutes, the New York Film Fest begins this Wednesday. New York City Horror Film Fest begins this Wednesday.
Yes.
Give us all the deets. Give us the website. Talk to me. Let Mike do it.
Because I was pumping it up before he got here.
Yeah, right? I was listening to it in the car on the FDR that was shut down, by the way, or I would have been here on time. I still would have been a little late, but who am I kidding? It's the New York City Horror Film Festival. It's nychorrorfest.com. As you know, we've got Michael Bean's new film, Bereavement. We've got the Lifetime Achievement Award for Mr. Robert Englund with a screening of the original Nightmare on Elm Street. We've got a few of the most buzzed films on the circuit today.
Is there a Freddy look-alike contest?
Hell no.
Okay.
But you're welcome to dress up.
He only has his Star Trek shirt, so...
Yeah. And we've got, like, Yellow Brick Road, which is a very buzzed
film.
Yeah,
really different kind of...
We've got Outcast from Scotland, which is sort of a really weird sort of... I don't want to say a werewolf movie.
But it's
not a werewolf movie because the thing doesn't turn into a werewolf, but it's about these race of people that are...
it's weird.
And we've got a great French film called... Joe? I'm having a brain fart.
The Pack.
The Pack is a great French film.
Stop. The Pack. Is it a werewolf movie?
No, it's
sort of a zombie film, and it's not really a zombie
ghouls.
Film.
They're ghouls.
Yeah, they're ghouls.
Ghouls.
That kind of... come to this little shack where this old lady has a diner.
And miners turn ghouls.
She sort of takes care of them and feeds them. But it's only one pack. It's not like a...
Dare I ask what she feeds them?
Yeah, that's basically...
Okay.
Yeah. You know, and we've just got... and for your campy lovers out there, for you guys who love the trauma films and the over-the-top comedy, over-the-top gore, we've got the world premiere of Wanton Baby, which stars Debbie Rashawn and Gutter Hansen.
Will Debbie Rashawn be at the fest?
I think Debbie's coming to that screening on Sunday.
You know she used to be here on VAI, didn't you know that?
No, I did not know that.
She used to be here before Night Shift.
Yeah. Let me tell you something about Debbie. Quick thing about Debbie, how much I love her. When we were shooting the television show that never aired, on the Fangoria network that never launched.
That's a good name for a book. The television show that never aired, and its subtitle, on the network that never launched.
But I had a show. We shot about 4 episodes. And I begged the producers. I said, I'm not an actor, and I'm not a host. I want to try this. I want to do it. It was their concept. They brought it to me. But you got to give me cue cards. Because I can't remember all of this. You're doing all the time. Oh, you're going to be fine. Oh, you're great. What'd you do? Yeah, but I need cue cards. They wouldn't let me have them. Debbie's a friend, and Debbie was working for the network. And Debbie came down and had a halfway through the day, and I am dying in front of a whole crew in front of me. I am up there being the host of this television show, and I can't remember anything. I mean, it's just, and the worse I was, the worse it got, because your brain just locks up when you're on camera like that. And at least for me, that's what happened. Because like I told Michael, I'm not an actor. And Debbie saw I was having trouble. She came down like halfway through the day. She stood there with the script that I wrote that I wanted blown up. And she mouthed the words. She stood directly behind the camera. And she was just stopping by to say hello. And she spent the next 7 hours just... because we shot 5 episodes in one day. Because I was just doing the bumps. Literally. And for that alone... I will always be... I mean, I adore that woman. I mean, I would do anything for her. That's not the reason the film is being screened. she is good in it. It's a lot of fun. The movie's over the top, campy, goofy. It's got Gunnar Hansen, the original Leatherface, in it. Susie Lorraine's in it. You know, an upcoming scream queen in her own right. And that film is the closing film. And that film is a lot of fun. And another thing about that program that is really, really cool is we've got the newest film from Terry Gilliam, which only one crowd has ever seen yet. They saw it. They did. It's called Ghost of Talladega, and it stars David Arquette, and it's a 18-minute short film that he did just like as a blast. He wanted
for
to
NASCAR
for the NASCAR networks, and it is a really, really fun little short film. Nobody's seen it yet. Just one screening for
NASCAR
did it on Halloween night, which was kind of an invite only thing.
Hey, Mike, this Kiss the Abyss film.
Oh, that's right. Thank you for bringing up Kiss the Abyss.
Is Michael Bay in that? No, I'm just kidding.
No.
No, but that's actually another really, really interesting film that, and a lot of films this year defy the horror movie sort of standard staples. You know, even within the genres, they changed it up. Like, the ghouls or zombies are actually like these dead miners, and, you know, like it's not just your typical story that you've heard a million times. And Kiss the Abyss has got a great storyline of a young couple in love, married, and the father of the girl is this rich guy who runs the town, and he hates the guy that she picked, but they're in true love. It's true love, and she's killed. She is murdered. And he's devastated, and the father's devastated. They hate each other. But the father knows of this legend out in the desert of this guy who can bring, for a price, can bring the dead back to life. But, much like out of a Stephen King novel.
There you go.
Yes.
They don't come back. She doesn't come back. And the guy tells them flat out. And
no returns.
He says, yeah, there's no returns. and if she acts a little strange from time to time, you know, don't worry about it, you know. But you can't come back. Don't bring her back here. Whatever I say, don't you ever come back here. And, of course, it rolls from there. And it's a really interesting little movie. And I particularly love that film.
That's Kiss the Abyss.
Kiss the Abyss.
Kiss the Abyss.
And specifically that one, I'll point out that the filmmakers did an awful lot with very, very little.
Will they be there?
They will be there. They are coming in for it.
And what are their names?
Ooh, off the top of my head.
Joe.
It's not in front of me. I remember so much, but a lot of the filmmakers
you
will
need
be
cue
there.
Cards?
Yeah, we need the cue cards.
What did I just say?
That's why I got the thing out. But the coolest thing is we have the directorial debut, the official New York
directed
premiere.
Directed by Ken Winkler.
Thank you.
Starring Nicole Moore.
That's okay.
Scott
I can hang
Wilson,
up on you.
Scott Wilson and Douglas Bennett. There you go.
Well, there it is.
But we have the directorial debut of Vincent D'Onofrio, his slasher rock musical, Don't Go Into the Woods, which I've seen already. And it's
like nothing you ever seen.
It's the music is great. And it's like nothing you've ever seen. And it was funny because the first time I saw it, I'm sitting there nudging Lisa and I'm going, this is like...
And you saw a rough cut of it.
Yes. And I'm going, this is like Once meets Friday the 13th. And she snickers about it. It's like, yeah, the music did sound a little bit like Once, that great musical that won an Oscar for the song. And sure enough, the guy who created the music for it on the panel when I saw it said, well, yeah, I was thinking about Once and blah, blah, blah.
Gotcha.
And it's good. The music is great.
He won an Academy Award. I was on the phone with him today.
No, the guys who did Once, they won an Academy Award for...
But it's the same guy who did the music?
No.
They were just inspired by that.
But Vincent's coming down to do a Q&A, and after the screening...
Vincent D'Onofrio will be there,
right. Friday night.
Are
we giving away passes for listeners here? What do we have happening?
We've got a new program we're running this year. We got a new thing we're trying.
What's that?
It's called Bodies and Seats.
It's called Pay for Your Ticket.
Well,
support this great event like you support public radio.
A lot of the things are selling out. Like the Lifetime Achievement thing is
just about gone. Just about.
The Don't Go Into the Woods is just about gone. But, you know, some films
Yellow
like
Brick Road, just about gone.
But what we've done is we came up with this program where people can come, make three choices, and we're going to have a rush line. So if there are any seats that are available, we will put bodies.
So we have nothing to give out here on the show.
We got mints.
You got mints.
I got free mints. I got mints.
Mike, well, I'm not going to leave you hanging like that. Okay. Of course not. I can give you some tickets.
All right. So how many pairs can we give away?
I got two pairs of tickets.
Two pairs. All right. So you have to email us at lifeislikesciencefiction@gmail.com and say you want New York Horror Fest. Put that in the title. All others pay cash.
Awesome. That's really cool, man.
Well, thank you, Mike.
You guys have had us on every year. I've got some free seats for you. I can't promise what they'll be because things are selling out so quickly this year.
I understand.
But we're going to see you at the festival.
If Joe sends me an invite.
You got the invite.
I have to call him. I have friends calling me, asking me, oh, hey, you're going to be at the party? I'm like, what party?
Joe, your partner.
No, I couldn't come last year. And then you tell me, but that panel's been cut. You're cut. Sorry.
Nobody does. Bull. We actually had the empty seat. And I have this corpse.
I heard.
So Joe made up a little sign. That's awesome. Yes. You were a rotted corpse, but you were on the panel.
Well, there it is. Well, so it starts this Wednesday. When does it end? Sunday?
It goes from Wednesday to Sunday. And I urge you guys all out there listening to come down and join us. Really what it is even if you are not the biggest horror fan in the world, come down. You're going to have a great time. I mean, for 9 years now, and for the last 4 years with Joe's involvement, I mean, it really is a great time, a great party. Every night there's the wine flows freely at the bar afterwards. There's a bar right inside the place. After parties every night. And the one thing about our festival that I always hate, when I started this film festival, I wanted to make sure it was so much different than other film festivals. Not just because we were one of two genre festivals in America, in the United States, that there was no separation. Something that always bugged me about the film festivals is there's always a party that you weren't invited to if you're just going to the festival. There's always a door that's closed, or there's always a door behind that door. Right. And if you can get in that first
velvet
door,
rope.
And there's another door that you can't get into. Well, screw that. That is not how we do it things, and we want these filmmakers and we want these people to be able to mingle with their fans and just everybody have a great time, and that's what it's all about, man.
There it is. And Joe, will you get Joe to wear his cape?
I don't have a cape.
Joe has a smoking jacket. I heard that on the way down here. I was sitting in traffic on the FDR.
Maybe I'll wear my black motorcycle jacket.
You know what they call Joe when he wears the velvet jacket, Chris?
Get him a.
They call him Crush SJ. Groove.
Super Joe.
Joe Crush Groove. That's right. Until you're tuned to Listen Sponsored Radio, WBAI. The name of the show.
Night Shift.
Thank you. Coming in. Every major city in the world is experiencing the same encounter.
They're everywhere.
The further we get out of the city, the better off we are.
He's right.
We have no idea what they're capable of.
We are having tickets here for... Why can't I hear myself? Joe, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Joe, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
I can't hear me. I can't hear myself. I don't know why I hear myself. Do you hear me?
I hear you.
Okay. Well, you're tuned to listen to Sponsored Radio WBAI 99.5 FM. Even though I can't hear myself, I can tell you that you just heard the trailer for Skyline, which we have tickets for. Universal Road Pictures. Don't look up. Your mic is on. Yes, it is. Oh, wait. No, there you are.
There you go. I was hearing tell through
that
your mic.
I couldn't tell that you weren't on.
I project.
Yes, you do. And what I want to say is we have tickets. You've got to come down to the station.
To the station.
Come down to the station. This is not like
what's
an
the
email
address?
Ticket. 120 Wall Street between 9 and 5. Actually, 9 and 6. You could probably come get it. But the tickets will be here. I'm going to put them at the front desk. We only got Joe, you bring extras? More?
No, I'm bringing extras.
Why?
Because I split them with you.
That's it?
That's it.
That's it.
You got 30, I got 30.
That's it.
That's it.
You lie.
No, no.
All right. But you got to come down to the station. We only have, you know, the few that Joe has seen fit to give us. Okay? And so they're going to go fast. So 120 Wall Street.
Hot ticket.
And you can, like I said, you can email us about info, but it's going to be 11 o'clock Thursday.
11 at 11.
Evening. Yes. Yes. 11 at 11. Chris, you going to drive down?
What day is that?
Chris, can I hang up on you now?
Chris, you know you're not going to drive down, but you should come down. Chris Griffin's coming.
Oh, really?
He's down. He's like, it's big science fiction. I haven't seen any of the trailers. I don't want to know.
Oh.
I know you want to know, Joe. Joe wants to know. Well, this is Night Shift, believe it or not. It's not actually the New York City Horror Fest. This is actually Night Shift, and we do have...
It was a good night.
It was a good night, yeah.
It was a good night.
We do have some stories for you, Joe.
We have stories for the audience.
I have stories for you. I have stories for you, Joe. But I had a theme, too, but we won't have time for the theme.
Okay, no theme.
No theme, but I did have a theme, just so you know.
I had a feeling that your theme, Mike, was the kind of the first question you asked Michael Bean, I think.
Which
was, Robert Englund? I think the first question you asked him, like some kind of...
That was all I had to do, was ask him one question. He was able to talk for 15 minutes on that one question.
There was four questions in that half hour.
Right.
Exactly.
Robert, what'd you have for breakfast? Well, I'll tell you what I have for breakfast. It reminds me of the time when I was...
I got up this morning and I was thinking about eggs, but then I was thinking back on my childhood when my mother used to make pancakes on those cool autumn days.
Exactly.
He should be a writer.
But they were both pretty
War
verbose.
And peace.
They were both pretty verbose. But Mike can give them all a run for their money, I'll tell you that.
Both of them, a bunch of great directors that they've worked with. So.
Yes, that's very true.
But they haven't worked with Mike Sargent.
No, but like I said, Mike Hine, give him a run for their money. His presence is as powerful as theirs. So, Joe, you have a story for me?
Yes, which of these stories would you prefer?
Just give me this story, your favorite.
My favorite first. My favorite.
I'll read my headline.
Go ahead.
Cannabis compounds make newborn females more masculine. I think that kind of says it all. All right, so Joe, what's your favorite story?
Well, Chris, I can read you about the new monkey found in Myanmar near China Dam Project. I could read you about whale mass strandings linked to hearing loss.
Oh, the whales.
The whales? What was the other
one?
What's
the third one?
How to celebrate the end of your child endangerment case.
Oh, that'll be a good one.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, let's hear that, Joe.
Chicago. A North Riverside woman has been charged with endangering her baby boy over the weekend. What? Charged.
Sound like you said charred.
Sorry. Sounds like you're booting up your computer. Chicago police officers say they found 27-year-old Janie Ridley drunkenly holding her three-month-old infant son under her arm like a football and struggling with a stroller on the 540 block of Harlem Avenue when they arrived at 4:30 p.m. Sunday, according to the Chicago Sun-Times. Ridley, of the 2300 block on Burr Oak Avenue, told police she had been drinking vodka. She and her husband were celebrating because the Illinois Department of Child and Family Services had dropped an investigation into her son's safety. Ridley is charged with misdemeanor child endangerment, disorderly conduct, and public intoxication. Paramedics took the baby to the McNeil Hospital for a minor injury. DCPS is investigating the incident and has taken custody of the boy.
Let me ask you a question. This may sound a little radical to you, but I mean, you know, if you want to adopt a child, okay, they make you take like a test, parenting class,
right,
to adopt a child.
Right.
But if you have a child.
Right.
Well, to quote Ron Howard's Parenthood,
yes,
as Keanu Reeves is,
yes,
you need a license to drive a car.
Yeah,
you need
a
license to fish.
That's it.
And you need a license to hunt. But they'll let any butthead be a parent.
That's very true. It's, you know, it's amazing. I have to say, I heard a parent this evening talking to her. They're both under five, and she's just saying, "Shut the f up, shut the f up, okay?" And that's just, she must have said it 12, 13 times. And I'm just thinking, mother of the year.
I got to say that, but that goes both ways, too, because I'll never forget this. I was on Amsterdam Avenue, right by the park before the Beacon Theater. Okay, and this mother had two kids. She had a baby girl in a stroller, and she had an older son, had to be like somewhere like 5 or 7 years old. And this kid is like not listening. And the mother's like, come over here, step away from the curb, come over here, kind of thing. And the little kid had the devil in his eyes, and he was like taking his foot, and he was like stepping in the street kind of thing. So at one point, she just like looked at him and said, if you do that one more time, I am going to beat you. Okay, and with this little demon smiled at her and jumped off the curb and jumped both feet off the sidewalk. This woman, in lightning fluid motion, reached up, snapped the switch off a tree, stripped the leaves off of it, grabbed him up by his collar, and as she was lifting him back on the, was pounding his butt with that switch. That kid.
This was not New York.
This was New York.
How long ago was
it? It was at the Beacon Theater, Mike. Like,
this was 20 years ago.
No, this was like maybe like 5 years ago.
Five years ago,
kid had to pause a moment before he started crying because I think he was still so awestruck by the lightning speed with which his mother had attacked like a gazelle on a wounded wildebeest.
Wow.
So, unbelievable.
Well, I don't know. It's hard to tell what led to that situation, okay?
You could tell the kid was just being
Yeah, but I've also seen, here's my thought on that. I just have to say on parenting, my thoughts on parenting. You know, I think when you start yelling, cursing at your child, especially at a very young age.
There's never a reason to use language.
I agree with that 100% because I never grew up that way. But the point I'm making is if you just flip out on them over everything, they completely tune you out, you know? Because I've seen it in the stores. You see it in the store. They're like, get over it! Get over it! And the child is like, you know, like not paying them any mind. Because, you know, they hear this yelling all the time. It doesn't mean anything. You know, I think
there's no weight behind the threats.
Of course, because this is how they're talked to all the time. They're just numb to it. Not to get into the whole other abusiveness thing, but
listen,
there it is.
Growing up, I was hit with, as Bill Cosby affectionately referred to, the belt, shoes, and a variety of household implements as I got older. It went from wood that started breaking to metal and then eventually plastic.
Your dad crack a 2x4 upside your head?
No, never had that.
So. Sucklud. what about you, Chris?
He was walking tall. He was puce and puffing with his 2x4.
Sucklud. You know, Joe would have lapses of memory. What were you punished severely as a child, Chris?
Well, not severely, but, you know, there was the strap.
The strap, yeah, the strap. My parents called it the strap.
Yeah, I mean, the strap.
Well, we called it the belt, but it was the strap.
Belt. 9 feet wide, 6 feet long, with hooks on it. If it touched you, it would rip the flesh off your body.
You know, I went to Catholic school, so there was also the nuns.
Yeah,
you know, which would affectionately crack you in the head with the ruler,
Cross the knuckles.
Yeah, or cross the knuckles. They did that.
You know what that sound is?
I mean, it wasn't anything. You know that would. You know,
I was standing in the hall one time, lined up, waiting to go into the classroom, and you know, I was like the second or the third last in line. I was one of the biggest kids in the class. And this little petite Spitfire nun, Sister Frances Daniels, came over and just...
Sister Frances Daniels.
Slapped me upside the head.
Oops!
And
upside the head.
It was one of those slaps where you have that momentary pause of deafness, and then sound comes back in. And I was like, excuse me, sister, well, what was that for? I didn't like the look of your face. I know you were up to something, and I just prevented you from doing it.
She's like,
Minority
Report. That was preventative.
That was preventative discipline.
That's right. I like that. Well, speaking of perhaps a sister.
Frances Daniels.
Maybe she had something to do with the whales. Read the whale story.
The whales.
The whales.
A little bit smaller than Frances. Whales mass strandings linked to hearing loss. In one of the biggest mass deaths of
20th century
coelacanths in Irish history, at least 33 whales have beached themselves on the northwest coast of County Donegal. They were found on Rutland Island near Buellpont on Saturday. It's thought they were the same group spotted in Outer Hebrides at the end of October. The whale deaths come just after the latest research into coelacanth strandings, which suggest that stranded whales and dolphins often suffer from hearing loss. This finding is the latest salvo in the long-running controversy over whether undersea noise pollution is harming whales.
That's interesting. Undersea noise pollution, yeah. Harming whales. So 33 whales are beached because of hearing loss.
It's not noise pollution. It's all the frickin' oil from the Gulf that's in
exactly,
your ears.
Exactly. It's their hearing. You know, and I was thinking about that this
evening. That's like that
it's
old joke.
And I have to say, it's interesting that for months now you haven't heard anything about the oil spill.
Right.
It's like it went away.
And it's not like they got there was no fingers oil spill. To pick it out of their ears.
Exactly. There was no oil spill.
Q-tips for whales.
Okay. We don't know what you're talking about. Did you see this latest article the other day at BP? Panel says there was no saving of money costs for security. Panel says BP is innocent. There was no oil spill.
And there are no dead oil
exactly.
here, guys.
And the whales, it's hearing loss. We don't know if it's oil in their ears. Who said anything about oil? There was no oil spill. BP was innocent. All right, so go ahead. So that's what it says?
That's what it says.
Chris.
Yeah.
Did you know there's a section, there's this website called Weird Stories or Weird News, of the Weird, something like that. And not News of the Weird, but one similar to that. And they break it down to categories, and they have weird auctions. I figure I should start sending you those every week.
Don't do that, but they have weird auctions.
They have weird auctions, so every week you can give us a weird auction.
Yeah, there's
story.
Always somebody selling something like stupid.
Something weird.
So. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it continues to happen like that.
Can you bring us weird auction stories every week? You know, we're revamping the show. I'll send you a memo. But starting next week, it'll be the new night shift, just so you know.
Oh, the new night shift.
Next week.
And co-hosts have to be present. Otherwise, they're not accounted for.
Mm.
Ooh.
Present and unaccounted. And we will rotate the co-host. Rotate the co-host, Pete, Al.
Well, that works in line with things that have to be present.
Rotate
Joe,
the
why,
co-host,
Joe,
please.
What's up, Joe? Are you mad at me or something? What's up?
I have no time for foolish people.
He has no time for himself.
Jeez, Joe. We're in love with other babe.
I've been loved plenty. You,
this section is called When the Love Goes Away. Well, your turn to listen to Sponsored Radio. What's that?
Your thing, I got to say this, Joe.
Say this.
You did an outstanding job of wrangling all that together tonight. What do you think of that?
Flattery will get you nowhere.
No, but I really do. You did it. Did he do an outstanding job of putting all that together? That was it was a great show tonight.
He thought it was great.
Well, Chris thinks it's great.
Yeah, well, there it is.
But he's easy to impress.
It's clinched.
It's
well, you are tuned to listen to Sponsored Radio, WBAI. The show is called Night Shift, and it is a late night, bizarre variety show, magazine format show, and it'll be more so in the coming weeks. And if you want to visit us on the web, you can go to lifeislikesciencefiction.com, or you can join us or like us or fan us on Facebook. And it's NITESHIFT. And if you want to learn more about just who Joe Massiri is, what's that site, Joe?
Fearsmag.com.
Fearsmag.com.
Which my partner Ed Flynn has been revamping the hell out of.
It's revamped. See, the New York Night Shift is being revamped, and so is Fearsmag.com. And BAI is being revamped as we speak, just so you know.
I can smell the fresh paint.
Fresh paint. That should be the name of the show. Fresh paint. You like that? Should we change the show? What do you think? The show formerly known as Night Shift. Chris?
Yes.
What do you think?
The revamping thing is always a really good thing.
Change is an inevitable part of evolution.
Yeah, I think that BAI is an incredible station, and I think that it's time, for things to, move ahead in any capacity they think is necessary.
And how would you apply that to your life, Mr. Taylor?
He gets a shave and a haircut.
Yeah.
But he's still Chris Taylor. He's never reinvented himself.
Still Freako.
Yeah.
Still Freako.
Well, it's just...
I guess it works for him.
Life is...
He stays under the radar. The Republicans aren't looking for him.
Republicans are really looking for Chris.
He likes to think they are.
He's been found.
Little Jack Little and our opening time today, friends. I've always wanted.
You know, for the next marathon, we should have Chris Taylor hats. Chris Taylor should make those little foil hats he wears up there in the mountains.
Yes, like they'll be like a turned around cap with long hair.
And foil.
Chris Taylor hats.
And foil.
With like foil, like a foil dunce cap that you put on top. I like that.
To keep out the signals from penetrating your brain.
I always saw Chris kind of like, you know, in The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Remember Mickey with that hat?
Mm-hmm.
I see Chris on the mountain directing
Chris
the brooms.
Chris on the mountain.
Yeah, I see that. Chris?
Yeah.
I can see that.
On the mountain.
Directing the brooms. Cannabis compounds make newborn females more masculine. When newborn female rats are given a substance mimicking cannabis, their brains become more masculine, as does their behavior.
Wow. Margaret
McCarthy from the University of Maryland in Baltimore and colleagues found that newborn female rats usually make more new cells than males in part of their brain called the amygdala, an area that governs social and emotional behavior. They also found that females had smaller endocannabinoid system, had a smaller endocannabinoid system involving brain receptors that react to cannabis. The correlation made them wonder whether injecting substances that mimic cannabis would alter the rate of cell proliferation in the amygdala. To find out, the team injected the rats with a compound that triggers cannabinoid receptors to the brain. They also injected a chemical that allowed them to see cell division in brain tissue to find out how these changes affected the rats' behavior. The team also studied the playing habits of the pups after 4 weeks. Without treatment, the female rats produced between 30 and 50% more glial cells, which help maintain... Well, I can't read because, you know...
When do you ever miss a word?
I don't. I just can't see. It's blurry. That's the problem.
Can't see it.
It's Galil.
I can't see it.
I kind of see, Captain. I have my glasses, too.
I can't see.
My contacts in. I can't read without my contacts. Help to maintain, which the Galil cells, which help to maintain homeostasis and protect neurons in the amygdala than males. They also played 30 to 40% less than males. They played, you hear me? Played 30-40% less than males, but females were given cannabinoid compounds, cell proliferation rates, and play behavior similar to those as men.
There you go.
So there. No, my question is,
when you're
in the lab, you're thinking about this, like, what about the rats' cannabinoid receptors? Let's give them something that mimics. I don't know. Do you think you could get a grant for this?
Somebody has. They're doing the research.
Clearly. Javier Fernandez-Ruiz from the Complutense University in Madrid, Spain, says the study is well-designed and convincing. Spain's getting in this. But he emphasizes what he describes a physiological process in the brains of rats, and that since the study did not use a plant-derived cannabinoid or higher doses to reflect that, they're like, we got to give them real stuff, basically. So I guess in Spain... That's what they're going to do.
There you go.
Real stuff.
And...
we're going to give them the real weed and cane in Spain. Hello, you on the air.
Hey, how are you?
How are you?
I was at the Making Waves benefit tonight. Great. Really was terrific. I know they're making a lot of changes in the programming. I'm wondering if that's affecting your show at all.
Well, you know what? That remains to be seen.
Okay, I hope not.
Well, I hope not, too. For this time being, we are revamping the show in an effort to maintain our status.
I see.
Okay.
Because I know that they're cutting back on Liquid Sound Lounge by half an hour.
Well.
And I think they're rescheduling Shocking Blue. You know, the time which, you know, I love those shows. And it's funny, it's ironic because this year I've contributed, you know, at the highest levels that I ever have. And, you know, you really feel a certain sense of kinship with your favorite shows. And, of course, I love your show, too.
Thank you.
And, you know, it's just at that time that I would be at this sort of level of involvement with the station financially, some of my favorite shows are getting, you know, rearranged or cut back. And I find that, you know, troubling.
Well, you know, the jury's out on all of it. You know,
but we do know that people...
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York.
If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.